Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP. On the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. You can listen online at wdiy.org. Today is August 20th, 2014, and it's my anniversary today, my wedding anniversary, 31 years. And with that information, the markets were mixed today. The Dow closing at 16,979, the NASDAQ down at 4526, and the S&P up at 1986, and the Dow was up as well. Tonight I have Rod Young in the studio with me, and we're going to share some stories and experiences with you that we hope will be helpful. Last week I discussed inheriting assets and what you need to know. It was a good show, a very interesting show as far as I'm concerned. So there was some interest in that. And I want to remind folks that if you want to access prior shows, they are available on wdiy.org or yourfinancialchoices.com and look for the podcast link. We are live tonight. We'll take your questions. Judy Ann is in the studio and she will answer your calls, take your information, and ask you to mute your radio so you can hear us without the delay and we can talk without confusion. If you are want to stay private, don't want to talk on air, you can give your information to Judy Ann and she'll bring that into the studio. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And the number to call in this evening is 610-758-8810. And email is available at yourfinancialchoices.com. So we have in the studio Rod Young, CPA and CFP. And
hi, Lori. How are you?
Guest host extraordinaire. Mm-hmm. It's so nice for us to both be in the studio at the same time.
It's been a little while.
Yes. So Rod's my go-to guy when I'm unable to host. So many of our listeners are familiar with your voice as well and all the knowledge that you have. But for those listeners who may not have caught you in the past, tell them a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Yeah, it's great to be back. It's great to be back with you. I always enjoy when we team up together here. And like you, I am a CPA and certified financial planner. And like you, I recently celebrated my 31st anniversary a couple weeks ago.
That's right, because we're mirror opposite. The same male Lori, female Rod.
So I've been involved in financial planning and providing financial advice, you know, since 1987. Been doing this a long time and love what I do and love trying to help people out.
Right. And I hope that we can help them out tonight with some stories that we want to share. And we're not going to talk specific in nature necessarily. We're not going to, you know, give away personal confidential client information, but we're going to talk about some stories and experiences that we've had that we think are going to help the listeners. And I also certainly welcome any listener to call with questions. It doesn't have to be on our topic this evening. It could trigger something when you're listening to us about something that may have happened to you or something that you expect might happen in the family, etc. And again, you can call in if you're interested. The phone number is 610-758-8810. So some of the stories, Rod and I kind of touched base before coming on the show tonight to talk about some of the things that, you know, were memorable for us in our past. And I'll start by just throwing out a story where we had to think outside the box. So what I want to relay here in this story is don't always take things at face value. Think of outside the box. So in my story, in 2012, had a client come to us. I knew that they were expecting a big sale of real estate in 2013, and I also knew that Medicare surtax was going to kick in 2013, as well as higher capital gains tax rates for those people in high brackets. Mm-hmm. So what I had said to them is, you know, is there any way we can accelerate this sale that you expect in 2013 into 2012? And the answer was no, they can't, because there was a family agreement the sale was going to take place in 2013. I said, you know, a second time, I went back to them. You sure? You don't think we can accelerate this? No. A third time, I had to apologize. I said, I'm so sorry
I keep being coming. Right,
yes.
Right.
But please, let's just see how we can make this happen. And, you know, I gave them some ideas around that, and which indicated a family meeting needed to, you know, be had. And there were some discussions and some gives and takes. And it worked out that they could accelerate the sale into 2012. And it was a very good result, and it was a great experience, and I was thrilled that I could help and also be, you know, the only accountant of all the family members who raised this idea. So it worked out really well. But the point of that story was, sometimes we think we have one situation in front of us, but if we kind of try to break it apart and pull it apart or look at it from a different angle. I'm left-handed, so I look at everything differently than everybody else, as you know. Sometimes you can get a better result just by, you know, considering all your options. And I imagine you've had...
Absolutely. And one of the things I love about your story, number one, is your kind of gentle or maybe not so gentle persistence with the with the client. And hopefully, as our listeners out there, you know, maybe one lesson from that story for them is, you know, when your financial advisor, your tax advisor comes to you and says, hold on, let's stop for a second and let's try to think of some different strategies, don't dismiss it out of hand. Pay attention. There's a reason that we're talking to you about those different strategies. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that one's a great story, particularly the persistence side of it.
Yeah.
I think was excellent. And you know, I've had many situations where the kind of surface answer was, oh, okay, that's just the way it's going to be. There's not a lot that we can do there, or not a lot that we can take advantage of there. And it's digging into the details and paying attention to the details and then taking that and thinking outside the box, where there are some gems of planning over the years. I've got a very, very long time client, I think, that's got a kind of a nice example. I think it was a geothermal energy efficient heat pump of some kind into their home, eligible for one of these energy efficient tax credits. Great. And literally the tax credit was worth $15,000-$20,000. It was a sizable tax credit. Only problem was, this is a retired client, no earned income, a lot of income off of tax exempt, municipal bonds. One of them was collecting Social Security. One of them wasn't. So, and they were also very charitable. So they were in a 0%, zero tax bracket. They haven't paid federal income tax in several years just because of their overall circumstances. Don't have much taxable income. So how are you going to take advantage of a tax credit, which is a dollar for dollar savings in your tax, if you don't have any, tax to take advantage of? So what we decided to do upon conversation with the with the client was, they have money in a retirement account. Why not convert some of those dollars that are in the individual retirement account over to a Roth IRA, mm-hmm. and do it utilizing the 15% bracket, mm-hmm. and do it over a period of several years, because this credit that they had carries forward until you use it up. So we literally now have $250,000 that is sitting in a Roth IRA, absolutely converted over there tax-free, which would have ultimately, down the road, when they reach age 70 and a half and have to start taking money out of their IRAs, that's going to push them to a point where they will be paying income tax again. And so it was just a fantastic strategy, one they had not considered, and one that would be very easily, I think, dismissed.
Right, and overlooked. I want to talk a little bit more about that story when we come back from our break, because I want to kind of talk about the initial interest in the geothermal credit as well.
Sure.
So, folks, if you have questions this evening, we're talking about sharing stories and experiences, financial in nature, that maybe our listeners will benefit from. First stories, talking about thinking outside the box. So when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a sec.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Do you have vinyl albums or 45s on your shelves that are taking up space and gathering dust? Why not donate them for a good cause? WDIY will receive profits from the records, and you will receive a tax deduction. For more information or to arrange for drop-off or pickup, call 610-694-8100 extension 3 or visit WDIY.org.
And welcome back. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I have in the studio with me this evening financial advisor Rod Young, who's a CPA and CFP as well. And we're talking about sharing stories and experiences that we hope will benefit our listeners about financial decisions, financial options, strategies, different types of situations you may be faced with. And we're just kind of sharing some of our stories. It's interesting. It's fun for us to, you know, break apart a situation and seeing if we can help clients in different ways. But one of the things we talked about is thinking outside the box. And then you had a client who you said had a geothermal credit. I want to go back for a moment and talk about that credit, because you had indicated that these folks really were in a low tax bracket because they were in their retirement years, had tax-exempt income, just a little bit of Social Security. So while we see, here again, thinking outside the box, sometimes we see people moving toward decisions based on how it's going to help them as far as tax savings or not. So the geothermal credit entails someone putting in a whole system around their house that's going to help reduce cost and maybe give energy back to the energy companies or back on the grid and different things like that. So a lot of folks are motivated by this huge credit that's available now, which we'll talk in a little bit more detail, you know, after you finish your story about your client. But they obviously didn't need it for the tax credit. That's not why they were doing it.
They didn't need it for the tax credit, you know, and as you kind of expand on the, you know, the story here, it makes me think back to the very first phone call that I had from the client, and that was long before we even talked about, hey, you know how we can use this credit, let's do a Roth IRA conversion. It was, hey, we're thinking about putting in a geothermal heat pump and we understand there's some kind of tax credit, tell us about that. And so I explained it to them and then went on to explain, you know, in your overall tax circumstances for the foreseeable future, to be perfectly honest with you, the credit really isn't going to provide you with any tax savings because there's no tax to be saved. And then it's one of those situations where, you know, you find out then 6 months later, 9 months later, they went ahead and they did the geothermal heat pump. They did it. They knew about the tax credit, knew it wasn't worth much to them. At least on the surface, but they wanted to do it anyway for a variety of reasons.
So the variety of reasons, so sometimes, again, thinking outside the box, it's not always just the tax decision that makes a good financial decision.
Absolutely.
Because for them, it could have been environmental reasons, but it also could have been saving energy cost.
Energy savings, absolutely.
For them, you know, and that has a give back to it, too. So this just kind of snowballed this great idea of the geothermal unit and then the tax credit. And then you said, let's get some tax on your return so we could offset it with this
absolutely.
Tax credit.
And we had some fun conversations as we did the numbers and said, do you realize what we can do here? And the idea of having $250,000 growing tax-free, not subject to those minimum pesky minimum distribution rules at age 70 and a half, It's very powerful financially.
Right. So not subject to Roth IRAs, not subject to required minimum distributions during your lifetime, and not subject to income tax, you know, as long as it's a qualified distribution. So that was a great strategy. Now, I do want to mention something about the geothermal credit, since we talked about it, because now someone might be saying, hey, this could be great for me. And you had also mentioned how big of a credit it was, and it just almost sounds like too good to be true. But basically, to encourage these energy-saving kind of capital expenditures on your home, there is a tax credit for geothermal heat pumps of 30% of the cost with no upper limit.
Right.
No upper limit. So that $15,000 tax credit you mentioned might, you know, would have come from about a $45,000 investment.
That's right.
But they get a third of that back, basically, right away in tax credits.
That's right.
And then over the lifetime of using that improvement, it will save on their own utility cost. And in some regards, if I'm right, is it the geothermal units that they can actually give back some to the power company?
I don't know, there might be certain ones.
So you could actually earn money on selling back power to some of the utilities.
Yep.
So there is more information about that, folks, on energystar.gov. That's energystar.gov. Many of the other residential energy credit type of expenditures, I think, were set to be done in 2013 and expired. So you're not going to see all the ones that we had for many, many years. But this geothermal one that's available, and I believe also for solar energy systems, they are going to be available through December 31st of 2016. Again, more information is available on energystar.gov, because you just want to make sure you also do everything that qualifies. So, for example, I think the geothermal heat pump has to be in your principal residence, but the solar energy systems, I believe, could be either your principal residence or, you know, second home. So
right.
More information on that on energystar.gov. So we just want to talk about some of the stories that we encounter, that Rod and I encounter working with clients. And that was a great one, kind of how it just simply started with someone wanting to get some energy improvements in their home, and how it ended up being a great financial implementation strategy that was available to them by converting some IRA monies to Roth. If you have questions this evening, the phone number is 610-758-8810. One other thing I wanted to mention about the thinking outside of the box and looking at income tax kind of in a different way, not taking things necessarily at face value. One of the things I sometimes see, Rod, and as accountants, we're probably guilty of this as well, because I back in our auditing days, what we would do is we would take the work papers from the prior year accountant, and then you repeat the work papers in the current year, and you kind of go through the same kind of sampling, random sampling, checking the information, making sure it seems consistent with the prior year. So auditing gives us a great skill set, I think, as far as kind of looking at the details, and maybe that's why we mm-hmm. like the details. But sometimes what I have found too is that people can be guilty of just following the same thing as the prior year. So you have to, folks, remember too, are you guilty of that as well? Because I have had, for example, where you might have a husband and wife who are married, and then one of the spouses dies. While they were married, their standard deduction when they did their tax return was high enough they never had to itemize. But now that there's only the widow or widower, they are a single filer, and now they may be eligible to itemize, because the standard deduction for a single person is so much lower than that married filing joint one. What I have seen happen from time to time is those single filers forget that they may now be able to itemize again.
Right.
They're so used to thinking in their head, I don't have to itemize because I can't itemize. I've never been able to itemize. And they kind of forget to look at their situation fresh. So that's one other time where I might say, think outside the box if you've had a life change.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you go from single to married, married to single, now have a child, don't have a child, things like that. So trying to get a fresh look on some of those things.
Sure. And that makes me think, you know, you talk about working with a surviving spouse, and I know both you and I have had, you know, many situations where we have worked with someone whose, you know, spouse has passed away. And I talked about this actually when I hosted the show when you were, I think, on vacation a few weeks ago. I talked a little bit about this. Many, and I'm sure you see this all the time, many married couples have what I'll call the financial spouse and the non-financial spouse, where one spouse, doesn't matter, husband or wife, handles the majority, if not all, of the family finances, and the non-financial spouse has very little knowledge about what's going on in the family finances. And, you know, that's not necessarily a terrible thing until something happens to that financial spouse. And I recently have worked in a situation where a spouse died suddenly, and the non-financial surviving spouse, came across some things that they were not aware of in their personal finances, and some not so pleasant things. And it got me thinking about how can the non-financial spouse have enough involvement in the family finances that should something happen to the financial spouse, they'll be able to relatively seamlessly step in and take over for themselves.
Well, you know, I want to add something to that, but we're going to take a break. And when I come back, I want to add something to that. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a second.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000. Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. For more information, visit wdiy.org.
And we are back. This is your host, Lori Siebert, and I have in the studio with me this evening Rod Young, who's the CPA and CFP, and we're talking about financial stories, sharing stories and experiences that we've had, and hopefully it will help folks who are listening. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Rod had just shared a story about the interesting interplay between a financial spouse and a non-financial spouse, and something kind of came to my mind when he was describing the story. How do we get a non-financial spouse to engage more with their advisors or the financial spouse? And one thing that came to mind in your situation, Rod, you had mentioned that the non-financial spouse was surprised by a few things. So I am just curious, you know, and want to throw out there, if I was the non-financial spouse, and you know, sometimes it is nice to live in ignorance because it's less energy we have to spend on thinking about it, less time we have to take. But if you don't engage, you may be exposing yourself to surprises that you'd rather not have at some later point. So might your antenna have to be raised to think about if you're in a situation where you have a financial spouse who says they're doing everything and you really don't need to be involved, should that raise your antenna? And then secondarily to that, does your financial spouse actually have advisors that you trust? Because if they don't, that could be a signal of something. Mm-hmm. If they don't have advisors, or if they don't have advisors that you're comfortable with, could that be a flag? And then maybe you need to push that issue, push that envelope.
Push for some kind of role in the family finances.
Right.
That doesn't have to be a major role. It's a role of at least understanding what's going on.
Right, right. And you have the, the right to that information.
Oh, of course.
And should. Jeff, we have a caller on line one. Hello, Paul. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Hi, how are you?
Good, and you?
Good. How can we help you?
Okay, I had a couple comments. First, in kind of the out-of-the-box team kind of thing, a few years back, I was a treasurer of a local chapter of a professional engineering organization, and we had, you know, some cash reserves on the order of $20,000, and they happened to be invested in a tax-free mutual fund. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how it had always been and was during my tenure. And my successor took a look at that and said, you know, this is kind of silly because we're tax exempt anyway.
Right, right, right.
We should put it into, you know, a taxable investment, which, of course, would have a bigger yield, you know, consistent with the risk and that kind of stuff that you could tolerate. But, you know, you just have that much more money flowing in. And I thought that was different enough. I remembered that. I did have a couple comments on the geothermal and solar credits,
mm-hmm.
Technical and financial. We have done both in our house. The geothermal system has now been in for 6 years. And this would probably lend itself to doing a show or part of a show later on with some of the people we were involved with, because it did have a lot of financial components to it.
Cool.
Either system. But the geothermal, the point I want to make is the incremental cost of the geothermal portion of it was only about $7,000, and that was for the two wells in the ground. Now, our house is built new, and you still need all the ductwork, you still need the controls, you still need some kind of box to produce hot and cold, whether it's an air heat pump, an oil burner, or whatever in the basement. And so those are pretty much constants. They're not going to change. The difference is that it's the wells out in the yard or the loops that produce your heat, and that is the difference in the cost. For us, it was $7,700, and we figured a year or two or back is when we had recouped that over what we would have been paying for a fossil fuel.
Wow.
So
wow.
Before you look at the tax considerations, at all, just on an operating cost basis, that made sense to us. The dynamics are a little different if you have an existing house, existing system, and you have to modify it. But one of my former coworkers, you know, his heat pump had reached the end of its life. He had to replace it with something and did the analysis that came out about the same place. As our energy consultant pointed out to us, what you're doing with that is you're really buying your heat up front and rolling it into your mortgage and essentially being able to get a tax deduction for it as well.
Great way to look at it.
Yeah, and, you know, from an operating perspective, our annual, it's about a 3,500-square-foot house in the Allentown area. Now, it's super insulated and very efficient and all that, so it's hard to isolate what contributes to what. But our annual, the heating component of our annual electric bill, it's an all-electric house, ranges between $600 and $800, and the summer cooling component is between $50 and $150.
Wow.
Is that a year?
That is a year.
Wow. Wow.
And, yeah, we are just as pleased as could be with it. So it can be very affordable if you get the right people and, you know, have it designed and sized right.
Well, that's a good comment to make, Paul, then, too, that in new homes, in construction, it might be easier to do and implement than in existing homes, but it's doable on both grounds.
That's correct. And then, now, our house was set up to accommodate a solar system. We just finally got around to doing that. And the unique thing about it is it's not only the panels on the roof, which do, in fact, sell some electricity back to PPL on the brightest sunny days. It's not sized big enough to accommodate all of our demand, roughly half. But we have a battery backup system tied in with it. And in round numbers, the solar panels on the roof were about $15,000. The battery backup and its controls were about another $7,000. I am told that all of that is eligible for the tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the advantage from my standpoint, a lot of people these days with brownouts, blackouts, we kind of live at the end of a long electric line, so
right.
the power goes off fairly frequently as those things go. Instead of putting in a generator and it stuff, which just sits there until the day you need it, mm-hmm. and then you have to go out and find fuel for it after you run it for more than a few hours, our solar panels continue to generate electricity and essentially return something to us every day, even if, you know, the power is on kind of thing. So it's not just a passive investment that sits there and waits for an emergency. It has a use on a day-to-day basis.
This is great, Paul. If you have a chance, maybe you could email me your information about your idea for having a future show on this topic, because this is something that I think folks should be interested in prior to 2016. I'm coming up on my break at this point, Paul, but I really thank you for calling. It was really interesting information.
Yeah, great call, Paul. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you both. Thanks for your time.
Okay.
And I will email you.
Okay, thanks. Have a good night. Folks, we're coming up on our break. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a sec.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Visit WDIY.org.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
And we are back. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices, and I have in the studio with me this evening Rod Young, CPA, CFP, financial advisor at Valley National. Paul's call was great. Yeah. Paul, I don't know if you're still listening, but first of all, I was writing notes like crazy while you were talking. A couple things I want to go back to for a moment that Paul had first mentioned about thinking outside the box and how I was referring to how people's situations can change, and sometimes people just keep doing the same thing
right.
each year and they forget to kind of look at it with fresh eyes or have someone else look at it with fresh eyes. And he had mentioned that he was working for a nonprofit and they had some investments in a tax-free mutual fund till someone said, hey, you're a nonprofit, you don't pay taxes, maybe you could put it somewhere other than a tax-free mutual fund. That is something that I think people don't quite understand. They think, oh, tax-free, and then they retire and they still have all this
tax-free bonds.
And they may just need to reallocate their portfolio. Maybe they do still have some taxable income, but maybe they don't. And so folks, you need to be aware of kind of the investments. I was talking to someone today and had said, going back to what I say frequently on the show, which is having a financial inventory, an inventory of your assets, your liabilities, and how much they're costing you on an after-tax basis so that you can make a better decision. So we were talking about some of our stories that we're sharing.
Non-financial and financial spouses.
I
think that's where we left off when Paul called.
Right.
Yeah.
So the non-financial spouse, I had kind of ended. You had mentioned that you can have both. Maybe that's not bad, but you don't want surprises. And then I had kind of, what I would encourage a non-financial spouse to do is to at least have that financial inventory that I just mentioned or stay plugged in at some point, because you don't want surprises. And if your spouse isn't telling you anything, it might not be that because they don't think you're interested. It might be because they don't want you to know.
Right. We don't we don't suddenly want all of you non-financial spouses out there to be suspicious, okay?
But especially when we're celebrating all these wedding anniversaries.
Right. And I can just envision, if my wife is listening tonight, because she is the non-financial spouse, I can just envision the conversation when I walk in the door. But anyway, one very simple way you know, the inventory is great. You know, have kind of an annual financial review every year. But a great one is if you use a CPA to prepare your tax return, you both have to sign off on that return. So make sure it's time to go over the tax return, and even if it costs you a few extra dollars to have the return prepared because you're spending a little extra time with the CPA, but sit down with the CPA and ask them to explain to you the major line items on the tax return and what they are and where they come from.
And what the lines on the W-2 mean, too.
Yeah.
Like the W-2 that shows so much. The W-2 shows if someone's putting money in their retirement account or not. Or
shows if somebody's making withdrawals from their retirement account.
Right.
You know, that would show up on the tax return and on the 1099.
Yeah.
So a lot of
information
yes.
on the tax return.
Yes.
So it's not that you're being snoopy. You want to be informed. And it's not that you don't trust your spouse. You want to protect both of you in case anything happens.
Absolutely.
So some of our stories, real quick, I want to talk about one more, and then let's go into some of our experiences. You know, so our experiences lead to these stories. Stories lead to the experiences. So we're kind of talking about a little bit of a mix. One thing I had wanted to mention, an experience I've had, especially in more recent years, I've had a lot of parents who have done okay on their own, you know, financially secure. We can't help ourselves but help our children now, unlike our parents who kind of like, you know, threw us in the water and let us swim. I feel
sure.
like our parents' generation were more like that. But I'm seeing more more parents now wanting to help their young adult children when they're going to purchase a home.
Sure.
So quite often I get the question, should I loan the money to my child? Should I give the money to my child? So we have had a few circumstances where parents decide to do a loan to the children. If it's structured properly, maybe you see an attorney draw up a mortgage. If it's structured properly, you can have it qualify as a mortgage. You get interest that you otherwise wouldn't have received, let's say if you left the money in the bank, so your kids are going to pay you a monthly amount. You get some interest. They get a deduction on their tax return for a mortgage. It's secured by their home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit of a benefit for both of you. You're getting a little bit more money. They're getting a better rate. So I want to talk a little bit more about the dynamics of that, but we have another call that came in from David on line one. David, can you hear us? Hello, David. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you, Laurie?
Good. How can I help you?
Yes, I had a question. A partnership
mm-hmm.
that lost the lease, and now had to go out of business in 2013, in filing the 2013
partnership
tax return
uh-huh.
for the partnership. This time it has an extension to file till September 15.
Yeah.
Now the the P&L it shows a small loss. What happens to the assets and liabilities? How do you handle the assets and liabilities on that last return?
Do you have a partnership agreement? Because if it's a partnership, there's more than one partner. There may be two. And you would have had an operating agreement or a partnership agreement?
Yes.
As far as, like, who put the assets in, who has what kind of interest in the partnership, I would expect that you, if it's everything's 50-50, then there
yes.
would be a distribution of the assets. And do you have an accountant to prepare your return? I would suggest going to an accountant to kind of close up everything and file the final returns. If you're
having one in mind, but before doing that, I would like to know, you know, myself what to expect, because I know that there was a small loss on the operations until the business closed. Because, as I said, we lost the lease.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing is the you know, how do you handle the assets and liabilities? You mentioned that the assets, depending on who made the contribution, but in our case, it's 50-50. So, you know, I would like, before going to the account, you know, to know what to expect.
So I would think, assuming what, you know, Lori said is correct, that there is an agreement that's going to govern, you know, it sounds to me like you're essentially going, you know, liquidating the partnership.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so there should be language in the agreement on what happens in the event termination and liquidation of the partnership. In theory, any assets that remain would be split.
Yeah, you're not
equally
selling them, so it's not a sale. It would be like a distribution.
A distribution, and any liabilities that remain, I don't know what the obligation would be to
To the individual partners?
Yeah,
right. Because you are actually treated as your own little entity. It's a flow through. The partnership's a flow through. So I would say if you're closing up and finishing, if there is any remaining liability, you're going to have to satisfy that in some regard.
Yeah, the partnership will have to satisfy it. It's not a responsibility then of the, it's still a responsibility of the partnership.
Yeah. So I think that you're heading in the right direction, David, but I think you probably need to sit down with an accountant and pull up your books, you know, and look at all your assets. What I have suggested for people, like when they're going to sell a business, and this is very similar to that, is you take a list of your depreciation, your assets, because whoever is going to kind of help you close the books, you have to know what value is left in those assets and how you're going to dispose of them. So you need to look at what assets you have. So take your depreciation schedule or a picture of those assets. And I don't mean a picture like literally like a camera. I mean your mind. Know what your assets are. Know what your liabilities are. Make a little inventory of that, like your profit and loss. You have to do a balance sheet, your assets and your liabilities. So get that all kind of defined, and then you'll know, or your accountant will know, how to proceed from there.
Okay, that distribution, is that anything to do with taxes?
The depreciation? Yes.
The distribution of assets
and liabilities. The distribution, yeah, in the end, if you're not going to sell assets to satisfy the mortgage or whatever, and you distribute them, you have to know what you're distributing, which is going to be the remaining basis in the property. And then you personally each will have a partnership interest, and you have an investment in the partnership, and there will be a cost basis in that partnership over the years. How much money you made, how many distributions you made, you have a cost basis. So you may have a gain or a loss on the dissolution of your partnership.
Absolutely.
It's like a sale.
So there could be a capital gains or capital loss.
Maybe, possibly.
When all is said and done.
Right.
That's correct.
In addition
to the normal operating
Correct.
Right.
Oh, okay. Let me then follow that up.
Okay.
Appreciate your comments.
All right, David. Have a good evening.
Thanks for the call.
You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, folks, sometimes it's easier probably to hire an accountant to kind of go over some of these more complicated situations. A radio show is probably not the best suited to answer complicated questions, but I hope that we help David get
in the
right direction.
Absolutely.
Right. There's always more analysis, and as we said earlier, Rod and I love details, and the hesitation here is there's lots of details that we can't even uncover in a quick phone call.
Right.
So it's best to kind of have that all identified and then go see a CPA and talk to them. Okay, so the mortgages, real quickly, I just wanted to mention that we have clients who've wanted to do that with families, and then sometimes they think they have the money, they could just give it to the child, but really, let's let the child maybe pay it for a while. Rather than doing it as a gift, maybe consider doing a loan.
I think it's a great strategy if someone's fortunate enough to be in a position to be the bank for their children,
mm-hmm.
like you said, Lori, to benefit both sides.
Yeah.
Benefit the child by helping them buy their first house and kind of being the bank for them, saving them some costs on the quote-unquote getting a mortgage and what have you. And then, along with their Social Security and their pension, they're now getting, a monthly income stream from the child, and it gives the child a chance to be,
to learn the discipline
and responsibility of and all that. I think it's great. I've had many clients who have done it.
And I think it shows a certain respect for their parents as well. You know, an appreciation. Thank you for giving me this opportunity and this benefit, and I respect you for doing it, and I want to pay you back, kind of a thing.
Yep.
We're coming up on our last break, so I want to get ready for that. And then when we come back, I want to share some of our experiences, and we're going to talk about the financial fear of retiring and something I call the financial delusion that you can retire. And then hopefully we can take a few minutes to talk about stock options, because we have a lot of companies in our Lehigh Valley that offer stock options, ESOPs, employee stock purchase plans. So I think it would be interesting to talk about that for a few minutes, because it's some of our more sophisticated planning, but I think it's quite interesting for those who are affected by it. So if you have questions, we're still available. The phone number is 610-758-8810, and we'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
And you are listening to WDIY Allentown, 88.1 FM and WDIY.org, serving the Lehigh Valley. Lehigh Valley weather, current conditions, 81 degrees under cloudy skies. Tonight, chance of showers, lows around 63. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, chance of showers with highs each day around 79 degrees. The time is now 6:45 p.m. Now back to your financial choices with our host, Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Jeff. And I'm thinking that Rod should come back every week because
thank you, Lori.
I'm having a lot of fun with Rod in the studio this evening.
I'll have the contract drawn up.
And I really appreciate the listeners who are calling in with questions as well. That certainly has added some great dialogue this evening, so I appreciate that. If you do have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We're talking about sharing stories and experiences to help in your financial life. Things to be aware of, thinking outside the box, you know, going in different directions. Now, as far as experiences go, Rod, one of the things we talked about, how many people have this financial fear of retiring.
Understandably so.
So let's talk about that for a minute.
And I don't know how what your experience is, Lori. I know mine has been people at all income levels. You know, fear of, am I ready to retire? That whole idea of suddenly after 40 years, you know, not receiving a paycheck is daunting to people at all income levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think my experience quite often is it sometimes takes multiple conversations over several years to get people to reach that point where you, as the planner, have been saying to them, "Yes, you can afford to retire. Yes, you can afford to retire," and even showing them on paper, showing them retirement projections, pulling all of the pieces together for them, showing them, explaining to them how it will all work and how the pieces will flow over time. I think it can take. It can take some time and some real involvement with a planner. Mm-hmm. I really encourage it, folks. If there's ever, it's one of the biggest financial decisions you'll ever make in your life is retirement, if not the biggest. And so if there's ever a time you sit down and work with a financial planner, this is the time.
You know, I had someone contact me today from a media source. They're writing an article on getting boomers to act, to get them to consider their retirement planning more. Their estate planning was the direction of the article. But I think it lends itself to retirement planning as well. Like, why not only are people concerned, can they retire, but what are they doing to prepare for that? So you had said some people have the fear of retiring, and I said sometimes people have the delusion that they can retire. So it's getting people to act, and how do we get people to act? And one of the things that I was considering, which I'll have my call tomorrow with this reporter, but one of the things, you know, that was kind of going through my mind is I think, just as I was talking about generational differences and where people come from, is I think so many of kind of baby boomers today lived with parents who had pensions, health care provided by the company, and they have Social Security. That's a little bit less sure for us today, the Social Security. For sure, health care. Most companies don't offer health care in retirement anymore. And pensions are practically gone. Some of the companies that had them have changed. So you might be working for a company that you still might get some kind of a pension, part of a pension, but the new people in the company aren't going to get the pension.
The world has changed in retirement planning. It's right. Been turned upside down over the past 20 years.
That's a good way to describe it. So sometimes, you know, our set of norms or ideals or whatever are based on something that doesn't exist anymore, which right. is why it helps sometimes to have kind of fresh eyes and new ideas and, again, thinking outside that box.
And it's not just the financial fear of retirement. It's then also having, even though where there are main roles as a financial planner, it's the conversations about, but what will I do when I retire? And one of my favorite parts of doing this kind of planning for so long is those people when they do retire, people who've worked very, very hard all their lives, inevitably, 6 months after they're retired, they basically are saying to you, I can't believe I didn't do it sooner. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I had time to work. Mm-hmm. They're in the best health they've had in years because they have time to exercise. They have lower stress. It's just so I love it when I see the ultimate results of it, both financially and personally for clients.
Sometimes what I see, as far as, you know, we're sharing our experiences and stories, is quite often I see some of the higher net worth clients retiring later. And so we're talking people wondering if they should retire, can they retire? And they're working till 70 sometimes. So we do want to mention that there are also people who think they can retire at 55, 60, 62. Yet we have people who are wealthy that we know could retire maybe
and
earlier
continue
and
to
don't.
Work.
Yeah. So, you know, I was trying to look up the stats today on if working longer gives you a longer life expectancy. And there were some studies that said yes in some circumstances and no in other circumstances. And I'm happy to say lawyers and accountants, I think they said they actually live longer than the normal average life expectancy, okay. which I wouldn't have expected because we have such stress. But I think those professions actually tend to work longer
right.
as well.
I agree.
Because it is a profession that it's not hard on the body. You know, there right. are people who work in professions that, you know, it takes a toll on the body. So it's just interesting. So just kind of know that each of your situations is unique to you. And that just because your neighbor may have worked at the same place or the same profession doesn't mean they have the same situation as you. So folks who may think they can't retire may be able to, and people who think they can retire maybe shouldn't. So it's really a very unique circumstance, unique situation, and each person should really work with an advisor and understand their situation individually and not base it on, you know, what the norm is or what the people in the neighborhood are doing or what their coworkers are doing. Yep. It really is very unique.
Yeah, our role here is not to plug the financial planning profession,
right.
but use a financial planner for this decision.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about stock options? Just because
sure.
they're so misunderstood, Rod, and there's a lot happening in the market right now with the market running up and
mm-hmm.
prices going up with companies like Air Products and Merck, where their stock is doing better than they have in years. You have people with stock options who are in the money, they call it now, meaning stock options are worth something. So can you, we have about 7 minutes, okay. 6 minutes, talk about maybe some of the different types of, when we talk about stock options, some of the definitions of that or some
sure.
misunderstandings.
Sure, and we could easily
do another show.
devote a whole show to this. So maybe we should just put that
yeah,
on the calendar sometime in the near future.
That and geothermal credits.
Yes. So just, you know, in a nutshell, and I do this every day, you know, with clients, working with executives and managers who are compensated in their, you know, significantly in their company stock. And so you have the typical ways that's done are stock options, which in a nutshell, is the right to buy a share of stock at a set price.
Okay.
And it's granted and it lasts for a period of time, and then that right to buy that stock at that price expires.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Typically in the corporate world, in the business world, that your stock options have a 10-year life is kind of standard. I've seen them 7 years, but you know, 10 years is kind of standard.
That's typically
okay. So that's a stock option. Other ways that executives and managers are compensated are in shares of restricted stock grants. Okay, and that's outright shares of stock. They don't own it yet. It vests at a certain point in the future, and by vest I mean that you then own it. You have a right to it at the time that it vests, and it's taxable at that point in time. So that's another way. So you have stock options, which is the right for you to buy the stock, and you have a restricted stock, which is the granting of shares to you that will vest sometime in the future
as an incentive for you to stay and contribute to the
company. Yes,
okay.
Absolutely. All the whole idea of this is to incentivize growing the value of the company. So we're going to, and it's a conceptually it's a great idea. So we're going to pay a significant portion of what we pay you in stock-based compensation mm-hmm. to incentivize you to do this.
Okay.
Then there are broader-based, what they call employee stock purchase plans, and typically that's available on payroll deduction to all full-time mm-hmm. employees in a company, where you can buy stock at a 15% discount. And it's capped at $20,000 in a year is the maximum you can contribute to one of those plans. You have people who, having stock in their 401k plans. So there are...
Like the company matches the employee's contribution with company stock.
Absolutely.
Or the employee may even be able to buy it.
Absolutely. Okay. So there are multiple ways for people to acquire company stock. And so the inevitable problem, if you want to put quotation marks around problem, is that you suddenly a significant portion of your net worth is tied up in the company stock. So not only is your salary coming from the company and your future retirement benefits may be coming from the company, but a lot of your net worth is tied up in company stock. And from a prudent financial planning standpoint, that's not necessarily a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some basic steps that you can kind of follow to help you to manage that risk, that concentration in your company
that
stock.
That exposure.
Mm-hmm. And with stock options, these are all very, it's all very general. So don't go out, don't go out tomorrow acting upon any of this. But, I think there's a sweet spot for managing and exercising your stock options. And I like to think of that as year 7, 8, or 9 of a 10-year stock option.
Mm-hmm.
In a perfect world, the stock would go up mm-hmm. continually, and we would exercise that stock option on the very last day of year 10 at its stock's highest value and walk away happy. We don't live in a perfect world, and stocks go up and down. So what happens if you wait until year 10 with your stock option, and 6 months from when it expires, something beyond your control, beyond the company's control, some external political event or something causes your company stock to tank in value, to drop in value.
Mm-hmm.
Now you don't. Now you only have 6 months for it to recover in value. You've lost all that value in your stock option. So there are good common sense approaches to kind of managing those stock options. What do you do with your restricted stock? Well, you know what you do with it? Sell it when it vests.
Mm-hmm. Because there's not a tax consequence, and sometimes people don't understand because you have the tax. Well, the tax consequence is only because with the restricted stock, it's reported in your W-2, in your wages, the value of it, the fair market value.
Absolutely.
The day they give it to you is included in your wages, and that becomes your basis.
That's correct.
So if you sell it for that same day, there's no gain or loss. So
if
you're otherwise over-concentrated in the company and there's no other reason to keep it, that is a good way to kind of diversify out of it then.
Absolutely. I've said this many times over the years. When that restricted stock vests, view it as if you're holding cash. It just happens to be in the form of a stock certificate. And if you had that value in cash today, would you buy those shares of the company stock? And the chances are, you probably would say no because of how much you already have riding on the company.
Mm-hmm.
And with there being, as you said, no further tax consequence from actually selling the shares, at, you know, unless something unusual is happening, you could go ahead and sell.
And real quick, because we're at the end here, yeah. I want to mention that sometimes that exposure to the company is in the 401k and there's employer stock in the plan, but mm-hmm. you also have to be aware of some special tax considerations for employer stock in a 401k. It's called net unrealized appreciation. It might give you some great tax benefits. You have to weigh that benefit against the exposure. So we're not saying necessarily you want to get out of it to reduce your exposure. You want to weigh that with the tax benefits of having employer stock and NUA, depending on your cost basis in that employer stock within your plan. So there, we just touched on the surface tonight. Oh. So Rod, we're going to have to come back
and do
a show just on this. And I know not everyone has this, but it is an area that I think affects a lot of companies in the Lehigh Valley. So I think it would be worthwhile doing a show maybe on options.
I'd love to do it.
So maybe in September or October, we'll come back and do that. Folks, thank you so much for being here this evening. Thank you, listeners, for calling in. We appreciate the questions. Rod, just a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Yep, love being here, Lori. Thank you.
It was really great. Yep. It's fun to have someone in the studio. Judy Ann, thanks for being here and taking the calls. Jeff, thank you as well. Stay tuned for Tom Druckenmiller with Intertradition Folk Music. Next week, I'm discussing paying for education. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices and have a great week.